The F and Rad Snowboard Podcast is presented by Vans. Season 6 of F and Rad is sponsored by Wired Snowboards, The Boardroom Snowboard Shop, Anon Optics, Crow's Nest Barbershops, and Tribute Board Shop in Nelson, BC. Support also comes from Mount Seymour, who opened today, and Grouse Mountain, the Peak of Vancouver. Book your skyride times at grousemountain.com. The guys from Tribute Board Shop have been supporting F and Rad since the beginning. Check them out on Instagram, Tribute Shop, and see Mark Fawcett in this week's Tribute Lounge explaining the winter stick boards. They offer a curated selection of the best snowboard, skateboard, and splitboard stuff you can buy. So whether you're a veteran rider or a new initiate into the board life, their incredibly friendly staff is in the shop 7 days a week to get you fitted with the right knowledge and the right gear for the season ahead. When you're in Nelson, be sure to swing by Tribute for high fives and good times, or go to tributeboardshop.ca and get yourself a Jamie Lynn Art Shop hoodie. Mark Castonguay is a pro snowboarder from the 90s, and he's fucking rad. Mark started riding in the 80s in Calgary, then moved to Whistler to become a legendary Whistler pro. This interview is my favorite type of interview, a trip down memory lane with a guy who lived and breathed snowboarding before energy drinks and snowboarding in the Olympics. Mark's the epitome of a true Canadian pro. So sit back and enjoy my conversation with Mark Castonguay.
We moved out at the beginning of the summer to go and snowboard up at the glacier at the camps. We were fully committed to snowboarding 100% summer and winter by this point.
Rad.
So we were, Chris Nichols and I had come out for the summer camps, and we actually moved into Paul Culling's house for the summer to hang out there. Spent our summer snowboarding up on the glacier with not part of the camps, not coaching, but there was public half pipes, there was public lanes, and of course we were friends with all the coaches. So we were poaching and, you know, stealing the chocolate bars from the camps and eating food and doing what we had to do to get by up there. But I ended up spending that winter up at Whistler. And actually that was the only winter, which was 90 or 91, that I actually lived the entire winter up at Whistler. So seeing me at Seymour would have been me living in the city at that point. And that would have just been like my local mountain, not local mountain that I was like going to on the regular, because I was still going up to Whistler on the regular. But with it being like half an hour away from East Van where I'm living, I'm booting up there to take some runs, and it's, you know, snowboarding was legitimately super fun and I wanted to boot up there and do it. So Seymour, Cypress, they were all right there. So that's why I would have been up there at that time.
Sick. Yeah. I just did a Cypress day today. This morning,
already? You know,
and it's crazy. Oh. Yeah. It's insane.
Yeah.
So you get four runs now on high speed quads. It takes about, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, and then it's too busy. So, but that's because of this COVID thing too, right?
Yeah.
People don't have anything to do.
People want to get out, man.
Yeah.
It's been tough on all of us for sure.
Yeah. It's been nuts.
So they're limiting you to four runs?
No, God, no. I just see it like the first four runs you can get, you know, like 10 minutes per run.
And then
after
nuts.
That, it's an hour a run.
Fair.
Yeah. And it's just people piling up there. Like you've never seen the kinds of, you know, like crowds on the road. I think they should just like cut it off. I think in the morning there should be somebody at a point on the road that says, okay, there's first 500 people get up there and they can just relax.
Not the best business plan right there, but
yeah, I'm not the best businessman for sure.
Oh man, when I was really young at snowboarding and like my first couple of years or whatever, we started going up to Sunshine Village, and I'm coming from a skateboard background and I'm not really hip to the jive of the way things work at a ski resort. It's skiing and golfing, you know, it's kind of higher end. You need money to do it, and typically, like, you know, I'm coming from a single mom family and somehow I'm buying a $200 pass, but I'm using it 160 days a year. But like from the background that I came with, you know, I'm going to punk rock shows and I'm skateboarding and I'm living a bit of a different lifestyle than your typical ski family that's renting chalets. And I'm telling you, man, like these lift lines that you talk about, we didn't even adhere to them. We would just barge to the front and grab the T-bar. And, you know, all these skiers in the lineup are, because there's not many snowboarders around, they're like clacking their poles up above their heads and they're like, hey, you guys. And we're like, whatever, man. Like, and we'd grab the T-bar and like, we're gone, like laughing back, looking back at them. And like,
unreal.
Just literally not caring about the way that it was supposed to be. And
I remember my friend broke his Division 23 and we came to a long lift line at the end and he just went right to the front. Yeah. And the person said, what do you think you're doing? He said, my board's broken. And they said, well, what does that have to do with anything? And he just sat on the chair and he went,
yeah, man. I mean, you, if you can just own it in this life, you'll get away with a lot of stuff. A lot of people might like squawk or cackle, you know, and raise their voice, but not much is going to happen.
They're pretty on it now up at the mountains. They've got 20 guys watching parking, making sure nobody's, because everybody's trying to do that.
Yeah, dude. And I'm not like that anymore. I don't want you to think that I am.
No, of course. I'm not either.
Yeah. No, I'm like 15 years old, 16 years old when I'm doing that. And now I'm the old guy, like seeing the 15, 16 year old guys doing that. I'm like, shaking my hand at them, like, hey, actually, you know what? I get it. You're a kid. I used to do it. That's fair.
It's good that you haven't lost that, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so where do you start snowboarding? It sounds like Calgary. Is that right? So is the Ken and the snowboard shop a part of your getting into snowboarding?
No. So I moved to Calgary with my family when I was 7 years old from Montreal, and basically we drove across the country in a van with the family all packed up, and we rolled over those last hills rolling into Calgary after 4 or 5 days driving across the country, hitting a moose in Ontario, knocking the mirror off our van,
oh,
and just like
God.
Full family adventure. But we get over that hill and I look west past Calgary and I see the mountains and I'm like, Mom, what is that? And she's like, that's the Rocky Mountains. And I was like, what? And like my jaw's on the floor. It was an incredibly beautiful, surreal sight. And I'm 7 and I'm literally freaking out already at 7 years old about this. So I instantly fell in love with the mountains and was drawn to the mountains right away and started sort of, you know, skiing up at Canada Olympic Park, which was at back then called Paskapoo.
Really?
Yeah. It used to be called Paskapoo. Now it's Canada Olympic Park. And we do these like, you know, zipper quick little runs that straight down the hill because it was a 10-second straight shot down the hill. But I started when I got a bit older, my mom would drive me in her like light blue Aries K car at 5:30 in the morning to South Center Shopping Mall, and I would meet the Sunshine Village ski bus there, and it was a ski bus that you paid $11 or whatever to get on, and it takes you to Sunshine Village, and then you got to meet it back in the parking lot at the end of the day. It takes you back to South Center. So I started like going on this bus really young, like 11, 12 years old, skiing like you know, four planker wanker up at Sunshine Village. And then not much more than a year or two later, I discovered skateboarding and I started skateboarding. And that whole lifestyle of just the freedom and the independence and the rebellious nature of skateboarding for me was so different than the organized sports that I was playing at the time. I was playing like high level, you know, AA hockey, rep hockey. And I'd gone through some negative experiences in it. There was, you know, shit happening, like lose a game, no pucks it next day at practice, skate till you puke, parents fighting in the stands, screaming. And it just wasn't my vibe. And it wasn't what I was all about. And I discovered skateboarding and it was kind of rebellious towards all that. And I really identified with it. And I still skate to this day, although not much and the knees hurt, but I'll carve around and rip it up once in a while. And then Calgary being like a, you know, 9 months a year winter city, I went from skiing to snowboarding. And the first board I got was I just bought used off my friend, Steve Freelander. It was like a Sims 1500 FE, I think, with just like slip-in bindings or something. And I literally just, me and my buds, like we started going to the golf courses in the wintertime, and we would like launch out of the sand traps and ride down the, you know, the hills at the golf course or whatever.
So fun.
Yeah. And it was just raw and really natural at the time. And that led me to going to Sunshine, and the equipment got better. And I started meeting other people that were doing it, like Nick's, and I can't remember who I originally started with, but yeah, we went to Sunshine Village, and at the time you get like a plastic laminated pass. You buy it for $200, and every day that you went, they give you a sticker to stick on the back that give you the date of that day, the day to snowboard. And my pass was like an inch and a half thick. I was just like going a lot with those stickers stuck onto it. And when, you know, a little bit back to what we were talking about earlier, like I was a guy who was focused on being good at what I was doing, but I guess more importantly is I was really just having a lot of fun with it. I was doing the winter skateboarding version that was allowed to me in Calgary. And Sunshine Village is where I completely cut all my chops and learned everything that I know. That place was so legit, and I was young and my blood was pumping through my body, and I didn't care that it was minus 25. I don't remember feeling the cold. I just was handling it, you know. And I was taking the $11 bus, and I didn't have much money, and like I'd go in at lunchtime and there was like these $8 hamburgers and all this food that I couldn't afford, but like I would just make it happen. Like they had a side dish of rice and corn that you were supposed to get with your burrito. And I would just order this plate, the $2 plate of rice and beans, and that would be my lunch, and I wouldn't get the burrito. But I was making it happen, you know? Like I
think
was doing
Nick's
it.
Put out a guide to cheap meals.
Yeah.
In one of the issues of Snowboard Canada. And it was ketchup soup. So you take the hot water for the tea, you put it in a bowl, and then you just bunch of squirts of ketchup in there and mix it and take the crackers. And now you essentially have tomato soup.
Yeah. And that, you know, the free crackers. I mean, there's to be fair, like a lot of my snowboard career with this, we were before the big money was involved, and we were ski bums, snowboard style. We were making it happen, and we never had like any doubt that we weren't going to make it happen. We just woke up every day just confident that we were going to achieve what we needed to do, get to the mountain, not be hungry, figure out like how to get there in our summer tire Dodge Chargers and up the foot and a half of snow that had fallen the night before. And you just do it. And we did do it, and we didn't question it or have any doubt, and it was totally raw and real, and it was a lot of fun. And even in the earlier years of my pro career, when we were traveling to Colorado and, you know, we were around the other American snowboarders and stuff, we still didn't really have much money. And I remember asking for $5 in the middle of Colorado at McDonald's while everyone's eating so that I could have a meal, you know.
Wow.
Or one guy would have some money and we'd go on a trip and he would pay for everything, and you'd scrounge up some money to pay for your half when you got back to BC. Like you just handled it. We just handled it, and we never worried about it, and it always worked out, and it was always huge smiles and tons of fun.
That's so sick.
Yeah.
So before you leave Alberta, you get linked up with Lindsay and Powderstick. Is that like, does he like notice you in a contest or something? Do you do well at competition? And then he's like, okay. Or is he just local and he's like, oh, these are the guys that have it in their heart?
Calgary had like the, what I would call the second hottest scene in Canada for snowboarding. BC, Whistler, Vancouver, I mean, this is where a lot of the guys and a lot of the clothing companies and the biggest mountains were and stuff. But Calgary was on it, man. Like, we had Powderstick snowboards there. We had Storm snowboards out of Calgary. Like you'd mentioned before, the snowboard shop was one of the original snowboard shops in
the world.
Canada, the world.
Yeah.
But I lived in the south of Calgary, and we were more like associated with Skater Sports Shop, and I ended up working there and being sponsored by them and stuff. But we, Alberta had like a amateur snowboard circuit. So we, you know, we would go and compete in all these contests, and yeah, I don't know how to say it. I did good at them. You know, I was a good competitor, and I was, you know, winning them and stuff. And
by all accounts, you were shredding at that time. You were one of the guys that, you know, was someone to watch. Like, holy shit, this guy's winning everything.
Yeah, it was fun competing. I was, like I said, I'd come from competitive hockey. And for me, I wasn't thinking of it that way. I was just doing what was fun and what was natural for me. And as it turns out, I guess the judges thought that was what they were looking for.
Sure.
But that, yeah, you get noticed. You quickly get into the scene, and you know who's who because of the contests. And that wore out quickly, because we kind of slayed the Alberta scene, and we started coming out to BC and competing against all the BC guys out here on their provincial circuit. So, you know, like Dano and Gary Pendergrass and Kearns and Paul Culling and Sean Johnson, and the list goes on. And we started competing against these guys, and I did good against them too, to be honest.
That would have made them kind of pissed, I'd imagine.
Well, it went down 100% like that, man. Like there was one of the first snowboard contests I came out to in BC. Nix and I drove out again with, you know, in his super low Honda Civic. I'm not sure that it had winter tires. And we drive 11 hours across the Rocky Mountains. You know, we get to Hemlock, and there's two contests, one Saturday, one Sunday. And we hotel up with all the BC guys and partying Friday night, compete Saturday, super party Saturday night, compete Sunday. And then like come awards time Sunday night, I had won both the contests. And it was, as the term was out here, I'd never really heard this term, but it was like gurn time for me. They were on me, and they were like yelling shit out from the crowd as I'm picking up my like first place neon pair of shitty cloth airwalk shoes for first place that some local shop had probably dug out of the back and given as a prize. And you know, they were just laying into us, and I was a bit softer back then, being from Calgary. I wasn't really used to the hammering that these guys were giving each other.
Sure.
As friends.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie, man, I'll expose myself, you know, like I drove back to Calgary with Nix, and I was like bent out of shape. And I was like, what's up with these guys? Why are they so mad at me and stuff? And he's like, calm down, dude. They're just like, you just came and you beat them, and they're like giving you the gears, you know? And it was, they were more like city exposed and more rough out here than I was used to. And I guess Calgary was a bit more like insular, and I hadn't been exposed to that kind of stuff yet. So
I the more that I interview people from all over the place, North Van in particular, where a lot of those guys are from,
absolutely
was nasty.
Yeah,
like shitty to each other, like bullying constantly.
Yeah.
And like it creates a Johnson and Kearns. It creates, I mean, I don't know, people say that Dano was gnarly. I'm like, that wonderful, nice, yeah, incredible human being, no way.
Yeah.
But yeah, sure, like there was, I can see the, it's, that's so long ago.
Yeah.
Like it's not like that anymore, for sure. You wouldn't go out of your way to be mean to anyone for any reason at this point.
But not
back
at
then
point.
That was normal. That was like completely par for the course. So you go back to Calgary,
yeah,
kind of like, what the hell was that all about?
Kind of, yeah. But at the same time, you know, man, I had earned their respect, and we became lifelong friends. Like,
great.
I can go see any of these guys on any given day, and there's just nothing but love. And it wasn't because I was winning the contest. You know, it was because I did end up handling it on the other side. And we ended up, you know, I've traveled 1,000 times with Dano in snowboard trips. I've lived with Kearns for 6 years in North Van. Oh, I rode for Paul Culling with Luxury later on. You know, like, these guys were fundamental in parts of my career as a snowboarder.
Once you get past that crusty outer layer and you're inside the group, it seems like a very protective place to be. Like, everybody looks out for each other, and you know, there's a reason that it's not easy to become friends with these guys, because they have a lot to give once you're there.
Well said. And I mean, that's absolutely true. And it's not like you're not allowed to be in it, or you have to earn your way into it. But yeah, like, to be on the inside, like any other group of friends anybody has in this world, of course you're looking out for each other. You got each other's back. And they just ended up being solid people to this day throughout their life. And I identify, like those, the hockey analogy I gave you earlier, you know, I ended up identifying more with skateboarders and snowboarders and the lifestyle and the attitudes and the, just the morals that these people had, were just way more of my vibe. I started out, like I said, on the team thing, and it just, my flow and my vibe in my life is just much more individual, but linked around a solid group of people that I have known now for 35 years. And I'm so proud and happy to still call so many of those people very good friends of mine.
That's incredible. That's so sick, dude.
Yeah.
So when do you, at what age do you make the jump to move out to BC? Like right after high school kind of thing?
Car was packed, grabbed my diploma, gone. Yeah. There was no doubt, you know, like, I knew where I needed to be, and Whistler was the place to be. I had, not that I was done with Calgary or done with Alberta, but I just knew that, like, somebody trying to make it in Hollywood, I had to go where it was.
Yeah.
And so that was like 89 or 90 or so.
Wow, we were perfect timing. Really?
Yeah. I move out there. I move into Paul Culling's house that summer. I get a place for the winter, and I start living out in BC, and I have not left. Like, I've lived out here now for way longer than I ever lived in Calgary. And I consider myself, you know, a British Columbian now more than I do a Calgarian. I was in Calgary from 7 to 18 years old, but I've been here now for 32 years. So,
yeah,
it was like 18 or 19. And I was sponsored by Powder Stick at the time. And
What would that entail? Like, what's Lindsay giving you? A box of boards, a board until it breaks, and then another one, or like some money? Is he giving you like a monthly $100 a month kind of thing? Or
it was thin, man. Like, I'm working a job after the summer coaching, and I'm laying bricks like in, you know, Whistler Village, and I'm working construction so that I can take the winter off.
Yep.
No, it was a board or two. Mm-hmm. If it breaks, call for another one.
Yeah.
There was no box of boards. Uh-huh. And there wasn't even numerous boards to even be selling them to get like some extra loot.
Right.
And it carried on like that through most of my career. We didn't have like business acumen back then. We were kids, you know, we were focused solely on going snowboarding every day. And I'm not trying to say that they were taking advantage of us. We just didn't even know to ask for salary, or we didn't know to ask for more boards. We would get a board and we would like sleep with it in our bed. Yeah. It was like incredible.
Totally.
To us, it was all we needed, because all we wanted was just to go up the mountain. And that kind of carried on throughout most of my career, which led towards the end of my career, people started signing contracts and started getting money and stuff. And that was sort of what was my out, was that I saw that I was getting older and the kids were starting to sign contracts. And I was like, okay, well, I'm seeing the writing on the wall here. So
unreal.
Yeah. But there was obviously a big gap in there too of my entire career.
Yeah. Did you have a clothing sponsor at the time, or did you pick one up when you're out here?
It was no different with the clothing companies than it was the snowboards. Yeah, like I went through a number of clothing companies, West Beach, Quicksilver, UGG, like, but all you're doing is getting an outfit or two.
Right.
And you're just wearing it all winter. And
then if you got a photo in a magazine or something, you could probably call them and say, like, send me another pair of those UGG boots or whatever.
Yeah. And they'd send you $100 or something. You get a shot in a magazine. There was stuff like that. But I mean, it wasn't game changing. I wasn't buying houses because of it or anything. it was my career, and snowboarding at that time was very ski bum.
Yeah.
We were just going up the mountain. We were struggling to make it. And it was also all we really needed and all we cared about.
Where did you fall on the style side of things? Like myself, I'm on the worst side of that. I have to work for every single thing, every trick. And some people it comes more natural to, like a Devin Walsh or someone like that. Where were you on that?
Style-wise, I'd like to think that my influence was and is definitely skateboarding. At the beginning of snowboarding, we still did the back knee tuck into the front knee thing, and that's just the way
Craig Kelly.
Yeah. It did switch to, you know, like spreading your legs apart and having a wider stance. But, I mean, when I started snowboarding, I think the typical stance width was like 19 and a half, and maybe by the time I got out it was 21 or maybe 22 inches was the norm, and I think from what I hear it might be more than that nowadays.
It's gone way bigger and it's come back smaller, so there's it's all over snowboarding now compared to like the time we're talking about. You could probably gather every single snowboarder on the whole planet and they wouldn't overwhelm Whistler. You know what I mean? Whereas now there are like such specialized things that there's groups of people that only talk about border cross. You know what I mean? There's people that are all about the Olympics, or people that are just free riders that you can make an entire career by just filming free ride parts. Yep. It's so sick that it's gone from like in those days, a lot of the guests will talk about how the pressure on during contests, and you're saying there was a 2-day contest at Hemlock, and I'm guessing there was a race day and then a freestyle day.
That's right.
Like, so you win the race, you win the freestyle.
Yeah.
Like you're just snowboarding. You're just doing whatever the contest says, right?
That's right.
You had to do every discipline.
You did. And it didn't matter if it was racing, because we were good at snowboarding, and I would go in the race because we were the faster guys. Like,
yeah.
So if there was guys that were focused on racing, and actually, like, I remember like Ross Rivagliati coming out to COP and having the directional boards or whatever they were called with the flat tail, and we were still like taking them out, you know, and all, because we were just charging. And
I remember those
and
days.
All credit to him. I mean, he obviously did great and was doing great back then too.
He was a freestyle rider in there too. He was on the cover of Transworld.
Absolutely. And my style was freestyle. It was big mountain. We were big mountain riders. You know, Whistler Blackcomb didn't really have half pipes. And if they did, you'd kind of like, why would we go ride that when there's thousands of acres of incredible terrain that just blows away doing a 4-foot air and a backside air and a half pipe? We're going to go ride this giant mountain. And so we rode the mountain, and we were all around riders, you know, and there'd be natural jumps that we would do freestyle. There was Dave Murray downhill that was groomed, and we would rip straight down Dave Murray downhill and do like 80-foot long backside 180s landing switch and just charging into the next roller that, you know, the World Cup ski guys were doing the men's World Cup downhill on. And that, so we were well versed in all of the aspects of snowboarding because we rode, you know, the biggest and best mountains out there.
So Whistler in those days, I mean, the skis are little toothpick twigs. So there's no powder skiing per se. You know, if people are going out to go powder skiing, they're going with a bunch of people to do powder eights. You know, remember that? Like, there's no free skiing, there's no free riding, and it's apparent right away that snowboards work better in powder. Like, that just starts happening. Yep. And the first snowboards, those powder stick ones, for example, are designed so that you're in the tail and they float really nice in powder. So does powder kind of become the focus at some point, or is it just like whatever the conditions are that day you go up? It's like, okay, it's a groomer day. Okay, it's a pow day. No difference between. Or are you like, shit, we're going to be first chair because it's, you know, deep snow today. It snowed a foot last night.
You're always aware of the conditions, no doubt. And yeah, if it's fresh powder, you're going to get up earlier than you typically might. I wouldn't say we were driven by powder or driven by jumps. We were just snowboarding, and there was no doubt about the love and the fun of it. And that's, we went up every day just because of snowboarding. It was something that was our sole focus year round. And, you know, I even slowed down on my skateboarding in the summer. We'd still go hang out at the Whistler Bowl, and stuff, but yeah, we were solely focused on snowboarding. We would go do it in the summer as much as we could. When I grew up in Calgary, before going to the Glacier, Neil Dufresne and I would drive up to Prince George, and they had like a sandboarding contest up there. And we'd sit in his car for like 14 hours from Calgary and drive up just to go sandboarding for a few runs. And that's, we were just focused, man. And it didn't matter what the conditions were. We were all mountain riders. And that versatility led to being able to adapt to entering a race or going into a half pipe. Say you're coming down the mountain and you just happen to go on the run that the half pipe's in. You're just going through it and then you're carrying on. You're not like hiking it and you're not stopping at it. And you're not even thinking about it. You're just like backside air, front air, just do your thing.
Yeah.
But it's just part of the 5,000 foot long run that you're on.
Let's talk about that. Being from Whistler gives you an advantage when, if you start traveling around to other small mountains where they're having these contests, right? Because a lot of places, I mean, where I'm from in Ontario, you might take 200 runs a night through a half pipe, and that's because there is nothing else. Yeah. There's no other thing. But, you know, and then when I get out here, it's like I wore that powder sucks shirt for a while, and it was not ironic. I was like, how do you even do this?
Yeah.
It's a nightmare. No. I remember Whistler being extremely scary because it's so big and it's so steep in sections. You're going so fast that, and especially if you ride with the locals. Like, I remember linking up with Anthony Vitelli.
Oh, there you go.
Was Kevin Young's roommate at the time in the city. And I'd met Kevin and Anthony back at Lake Ridge. And we did a day riding, and I was like, that was the most uncomfortable day of my life. Like, how do you guys know when to turn? Like, there's, you got to make these big turns. And then you look over the side and you're like, if I would have missed that turn and gone through that rope at that speed, I would be dead.
It's big mountain stuff, man. It's big mountain experience. And I'm so glad that, to me, that wasn't that much of a shock. You know, like Lake Louise and Sunshine, they were pretty big mountains. And I was young enough and full of bravado enough that by the time I got to Whistler Blackcomb and I was hanging with the guys that had spent a year or two there riding, it wasn't that much of a shock to me. And as a matter of fact, you know, to be honest, I looked at the terrain and I was chomping at the bit. I loved it. And I loved the pace at which we snowboarded. We snowboarded really fast. And you alluded to, you know, going to the other mountains in wherever, Colorado or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they had good mountains too, but the local guys weren't riding as fast as we were. We charge. We charge at everything, and that's just what we're used to. Like, and there's a funny story surrounding charging, actually. I learned how to charge in snowboarding because of two pros coming out to Sunshine Village before I'd started making my way out to BC and living in Whistler. Don Schwartz and Alex Warburton came to Sunshine Village.
Rad.
And they, you know, knew who we were or whatever. And we obviously knew who they were. And we all linked up at the bottom of the gondola. We went up the gondola and we went to first run of the day to Wawa T Bar, and we all go up Wawa T Bar and we get to the top, strap in, and they go raging down, and me and whoever I'm with, probably Nick's or something, you know, like we're a touch behind because we're not keeping up with them. And they get to the lift and they like load up and start going. And Nick's and I, like, or, you know, we show up like four chairs later and we're like, hey, man, like, what are you doing? Why didn't you wait? And they're like, there's no waiting in snowboarding. And I was like, oh, okay. So charge and make it happen. Like, so that charge attitude just went on throughout my entire career. That's the way Whistler was. It was full charge, full time. And when guys would come from out of town, and it was like, keep up, man, because we're going for it.
So you've got this idea in your head that if you work hard during the summer laying brick or, you know, construction work,
yeah,
you can bank just enough money that you can not work all winter. Because I know a lot of people got those night jobs, right? Like, so that you could, you get up in the morning, you'd shred until you were, your legs were bagged, and then you'd work at night, and then you'd sleep or party or whatever. But you were like intent on like, I'm not working in the winter. Winter's when I snowboard.
Yeah. I didn't work in the winter. I worked in the summer, and yeah, we partied at night, man. It was I mean, it was Whistler, and we were, you know, we were 20 to 50 kids in our early 20s, and we were kind of the only 20 to 50 snowboarders in town in the late 80s, first couple of years of the 90s. You saw a snowboarder on the mountain, you knew instantly who it was, even if you were on the chair and they were like in the bowl, you know, like one mountain bowl over, you could see who it was based on their style or their one outfit they've been given from their clothing sponsor. You could tell who it was. And you really honestly knew each other on the mountain, and that carried on at night. You know, we were all friends down in the village, and we all had to live in big groups of three or four or five in houses to make rent and share meals. But yeah, we were more intent on having fun and partying and snowboarding in the day. It was all we really gave a crap about.
That actually just sounds like so much fun, like such good friendships and like such a good time. Like, okay, 7 days a week we're snowboarding.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
No, it's not that unbelievable. It's an easy choice, actually. It's fun as hell.
Well, I've been talking about Nick's being part of the Creekside Mob for 6 years now, basically, because when I went up there, I remember being told, watch out for the Creekside Mob, as though it was like they were just out making people, getting people hurt or something.
Spikes on their elbows. Yeah, like, totally. Yeah.
Like the North Shore of Oahu or something, like cutting leashes. So I was up in that half pipe above, just above the lodge on Blackcomb. There was a half pipe that was
up off to the right.
Jersey Cream or something, above Jersey Cream. Or it was, and that half pipe, a lot of cool shit went down that
for
half
pipe.
Not by me, but when I was when I was up there, I was riding it, and I was trying to show off because I felt like, you know, there's pro snowboarders around. I've told Nick's this before, and someone said, that's Nick's, and I was like, oh, cool. Well, I want to do something in front of him, because I think the way you become a pro is another pro sees you and says, well, now you're pro. Or like, oh, great.
Come join us.
Yeah. And there's a lot of truth to that, you know, like Sean Johnson giving Chris Duffesy his actual
setup. That is the way it works.
Yeah. Right. So I was kind of like, all right, maybe I'll get Nick's attention. And I did as good an air as I could do. And as I was coming down, I realized I'm going to crash into Nick's. And I turned my board sideways and just sprayed him like
snow spray.
It looked intentional. Oh, like, dude. He was like, what the fuck would you do that for?
What's up, Ontario?
And, exactly. And then I was like, oh no, I missed my shot.
Yeah. But, well, at least you took your shot, man. A lot of people don't.
And I was also afraid, okay, now he's going to kill me.
Yeah. Well, first off, he was not like a card carrying Creekside member guy. Those guys were all our friends, and it's not like it was them or us or whatever. Right. We were super tight. But the Creekside Mob guys, they actually lived down at Creekside. And they all lived in like this particular townhouse complex. And
I know
they,
the one.
They all identified themselves as that. And they kind of, you know, grouped up and got that going and stuff. And it's not that we weren't on the outside looking in. We just weren't card carrying, living there guys, but we were hanging there. We were partying there. These guys were just as good of friends with us as anybody else who wasn't living in there. And they just kind of made a fun little group. Yeah. I never saw them as being scary guys, but you know, like in life, I remember like being that age, like you don't see other human beings, you know, like you're walking through the village and you're with your buds and you don't see people dining on the patios and you don't see like the skiers walk, you know, walking towards you or whatever. You're kind of insular and your shoulders are cocked a bit and you're feeling good, you know? And I just think that might be a little bit what you're talking about. There was kind of an air about us and yeah, man, like we probably looked like we owned it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you kind of have to, right? Because if you're going to take advantage of the great conditions and the deals to be had, you gotta own it and you gotta charge it.
Yeah. Charging. Totally. That really does sum up that era in Whistler snowboarding. Like I can remember saying to Anthony, like, why do you ride this fast? Like, why don't we stop and hit all these hits? Like you're riding past 50 hits to air that one roller thing.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, but we're airing the roller at like 200 miles
an
hour.
That's right. And doing 80 foot long backside 180s. Yeah.
Kern says on his episode, when he went to Seymour, he was like, oh, this is like a skate park.
Yeah.
Like we're going slower. We're hitting all these hits. It's like, it's literally feels like being at a skate park. Yeah. 'Cause now you're riding with your buddies, like, you and I are
slower
here.
Pace,
like,
yeah.
Like, oh, you hit it. I can time myself. I'll be right behind it.
Yeah.
You can't do that at Whistler when you're going 200 miles an hour. A collision at that speed would be like deadly.
And yeah. So at Seymour, you all stop at the top of the jump and you watch each other go off totally. And then you stop after the jump and watch your buds. And
not
it
completely.
Is like that.
You don't even have to stop. Well, you're going so slow most of the time anyways. But yes, I hear what you're saying.
But yeah, Whistler is totally not like that. Whistler is off the chair, strap in, you know, we wait for each other or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're launching and you're carrying on and you're trying to keep up and it's total game on up
game
there.
Game on. Yeah.
It's very much
charging.
Game on and it's charging and
yeah.
And hopefully at the speed you're going at, you can look back and see your buddy do his trick or whatever, or maybe he's doing it in front of you and you can catch a glimpse, but it's very fast riding. And anyone who'd ever come here to Whistler at that time was always in shock. And we were always in shock by going to Colorado or California and about the way that they were snowboarding, because it was slow and weird to us and we didn't really understand why they were doing
that. I totally I totally understand, like when you roll up with a group, and it still happens now.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are all about Instagramming and they're like, oh, can you get a shot of this? Hold on. And I'm guilty of it for sure. Sometimes I'm charging. Sometimes it's not that great. So I'm like, let's try and make this look better.
Yep.
We'll take a picture today or we'll slow down because filming and taking photos is completely different than charging.
Yeah.
You can't charge and take photos of that. It's just your photographer would have to sit there for a few laps and not actually get any riding in.
You just take pictures in your mind of that stuff. And, you know, shooting days are shooting days and videoing days are videoing days. And that's what you're doing. But to be fair, when you're riding, man, it's just top to bottom, fast. Let's go.
Still like that. You know who I rode
with? That's good. That's great to hear.
At Snowbird. Jeff Davis. Do you remember that name?
Of course.
And he still charges like that right to this day.
Perfect.
Like, there's a part of Snowbird that is super steep, super fast, super fun. They've got their hits all dialed.
Nice.
It's just incredible. It's a rad way to ride. for me, it's a little bit scary if it's a new mountain and I'm riding with people that know it really well.
Yeah.
Because I tend to go really fast and then, oh, wait, I didn't know I'm going the wrong way or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I still have a bit of that. It's fun to charge, man. Charging's definitely, like you said, you can put your shoulders up. You can feel pretty good. Yeah. You get in the lift line. People are going, wow, that guy was going really fast. Yeah. He must be really good at this. So let's talk sponsors wise.
Sure.
What's the transition from, is there anything between Powder Stick and Luxury? Like, do you do a year or two on some other board brands while you're in Whistler?
Not ones that were as predominant as Luxury. There might've been, you know, just a board sponsor, again, no money or whatever. I don't actually remember which boards I was riding and after Powder Stick, before Luxury. But yeah, Luxury came to play in 94. Mm-hmm. And Paul Culling started the company, and just out of his little apartment and in the West End of Vancouver. And he started a snowboard company, and he took Sheen and Derek Scott and myself and Mike Estes on, and Lance Mountain.
Oh yeah. Lance had a, yeah. Oh, that was awesome.
Yeah. And, I got the 54 size board, and Derek Scott had the small, he was the younger kid. So yeah. He got like the shorter board, and I think Sheen had like the 51 or something. But that was legit for me because yeah, I got a pro model.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn, this is freaking awesome, man. Like, cool. And Paul gave us full rein to pick whatever graphic we wanted. And, you know, I had been, and still to this day have been, playing hockey all my life. I love it. It's a great pastime for me. I'm fully in love with playing hockey, and I've been a fan of hockey my whole life. And, as a fan, you always have a favorite team. And for me, like, the first team I ended up liking, and I don't even know why or how this happened, but I liked the Nordiques, you know, when I was living back in Montreal. And I like to think that I liked the Nordiques because living in Montreal, everybody's like, oh, Habs, Canadians.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
yeah,
maybe this is part of my rebellious, you know, like, not wanting to be a team guy, is like, well, screw you guys, I'm gonna like the Nordiques then.
Rad.
And they were like a shitty team, man. Like, they were always the underdog, and they were always, like, I think one season they won like 12 games or something out of 80. They were terrible.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I kind of liked that about them. And I liked the underdog, you know, vibe that they were carrying. And I liked liking things that other people didn't know about or didn't like yet. So I chose the Nordiques graphic, and, you know, I put the home ice up on the top and the Stanley Cup on the bottom and my name in there and stuff. And little did I have any foresight to think about, this is going to be the worst frickin' selling board ever, because as a fan of the, you know, if somebody likes the Flames or the frickin' Detroit Red Wings, right, they're not going to buy this right board. And really, like, what does hockey have to do with snowboarding anyways? But it was what I wanted to do, and I'm totally proud of it. Like, I
yeah,
still to this day love it. And it just was what it was. It's not like I was going to become rich or Paul was going to go broke because of that graphic.
And right.
It was what I wanted.
And it fit in the line really well. I remember seeing that board line in Vegas. I remember the booth.
Nice.
And I remember being like, this company, because I knew the Mervin backstory. I knew they were being made at Mervin.
That's right.
And having a Mervin board, they rode really well.
Oh, we were so proud to be made by Mervin.
So in the exact same way that you're like going as the underdog guy, I'm like, I'd like to ride a Lib or a Gnu, but I could ride a Luxury.
Yeah.
And that's like, I'm still riding a Mervin board.
Yep, that's right.
And I remember looking at the graphics being like, these are pro models.
Yeah.
Like, you can tell they're pro models,
that's
because
right,
each one has a distinct,
super distinct
flavor, a distinct, like, a personality.
Absolutely.
It's not a line like what was happening at that time in, like, with Ride and with Burton.
Yeah,
they started dividing these into these lines, like, okay, this is the custom and this is the free ride or
that's
whatever
right
it is, right?
So he was kind of in with the Mervin guys, And he was able to, he obviously did have some business acumen, and he was able to know how to start a company and make that happen officially on paper and get somebody to build his boards for him. And he made it happen. You know, like I was just a pro rider. And again, I was solely focused on just riding. And that's a good thing because it kept me on top of my game. And he got on top of his game, which was being a business owner and starting a company. And he did all the legwork. He never asked us, you know, about much of how to run the business. It was always just him doing it. And I'm glad that you think the line was, you know, cool to look at, because it we all very much got to do live a lifelong dream. What would your pro model look like if you got to have one? You know, and I got to do that, and I've heard nowadays that Nordiques board, rip-off graphic Nordiques board, is a pretty sought after like little gem of a board to find. They're hard to get, and it's not like finding a Burton that were mass made. There wasn't that many of them, and the true snowboard collectors, of which I know there are, you know, like
tons,
like our friend Mike Strato, you know, he's a board collector and he likes finding old gems.
Yeah.
And I've been in his basement and I've seen his skateboard and snowboard collection and his man cave.
It's pretty sick.
It's hard to come across these kinds of smaller company, really unique boards. And
if you bought that board, you bought it because you wanted to ride it.
They had great shapes. They were from a legit company.
Totally.
They had vibrant graphics.
They were only sold in core shops, so you're not getting them at some weird sport check or whatever.
As I think back now, it doesn't really matter how many sold to me because I wasn't getting royalties or anything anyway. So Paul paid me like $500 a month or whatever, and it was good enough to make it. I was probably on EI at the time too, and compensating my luxury salary with some government money. But again, we were just making it, and we weren't aspiring to be like business snowboard guys. We were actually just snowboarders.
Did Paul take you on any team trips? Like, did you guys do?
Big time.
Yeah. Sick.
Yeah. We went to Japan with luxury. Nice. We went to Europe with luxury.
Wow.
The Japan one was pretty cool. There was, Japan was a trip. It was my first and only ever time there. The food was like outrageous. I was like, where's McDonald's, dude? I can't eat this fish head. Like, and I'm not coming down on them for what they eat.
No, I got you.
It was like savage what they would put down in front of you on your plate for breakfast. I was like, I can't identify with any of this. And I got a pretty strong stomach, but it was tough to eat there. But we got up to the mountain and we were, doing demos and stuff on the jumps and stuff, and all of that was fine. But we had Whistler Blackcomb back home, and there was great powder, and we were ripping the trees because they weren't really riding in the trees as a culture. They don't really ride in the trees very much. Mm-hmm. So there was lots of good riding. But at the base of the ski resort, there was these kind of motorcycle-shaped like ski-doos that had one ski at the front and just a skinny single track at the back. And like our guide guy who got hired by the distributor, the luxury distributor in Japan, to tour us around, we were like, what are those things? And he's like, oh, they're just like rental ski, like motorcycles, things that people rent if they want. And there's a little track over there. And we were like, sack, and like just dropped the snowboards and freaking like jumped on these things and like raged on them for hours because they were like so different than anything we'd ever seen.
I've seen them in a movie or something, yeah, you know, but
were,
not
they were unique and they were different for us, and we were like, okay, the snowboarding's great, but these things are sweet, man. Like, we what are these all about?
The luxury teams on these mono mobiles or whatever they
would
call
them. And those were really different times too back then, man. Like, you know, we went to the trade show, which was in this big hall, and Paul set us up with like a bench and a little display of our graphics and our boards. And he brought like a mannequin and got them all dolled up in hockey equipment and helmet and stuff. And I was sitting at the bench behind the table, like signing this pile of posters that Paul had printed up. And there's a lineup of like Japanese folks like wanting to get my autograph. And I'm thinking, I don't really know that they know who I am. They're not speaking a lick of English. And to be fair, I'm not speaking Japanese either.
Yeah.
But like, you know, you're signing and you're like, oh, thank you. Thank you. And then we're looking at each other, me and Sheen, and you know, we're like, this is kind of weird. And after you sign like 50, 60 of them, we sort of start laughing and we're like, start signing like random names and random, like writing random things like that just wasn't our name. And it definitely wasn't our signature, but nobody knew any different.
They're like, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, totally. Very appreciative, very kind people.
Oh, yeah.
And, and like I was saying about just different times, society wise, we would go to the mall in Japan and we'd go to the toy store and we'd buy like these replica guns, and they had Glocks and all these, like, I'm not a gun guy, but they had, I can remember the name Glock, yeah, but they had Glocks and these different guns, and you could buy them from the toy store in the mall, load them up with BBs, and we were like running around the mall like shooting each other with these replica guns, like God, just like raging, you know, early 20-year-old kids or whatever. And of course nowadays you'd straight get shot or
arrested
or whatever, yeah, like
totally,
but it was different times back then and you could do that kind of stuff, and
that's insane.
It was just fun.
Anyone else from the team on that trip? Did Lance Mountain go on any trips with you guys?
No, I never snowboarded with Lance, but Derek was there, Sheen was there. I believe we had gone with probably some of the Mervin guys too, like I think Jamie Lynn was on that trip too.
Rad.
But they were kind of, you know, we had our own guide and they had their guide. As teams go in Japan, you get given a guide and he tours you around to, we're eating here tonight and you're staying here tonight. And
did so you do like karaoke or like strip clubs and shit like that?
There was like these, not strip clubs and not karaoke, but there was like electronic districts and it was all very bright. And like, there was like these big arcades with like these steel ball, like Plinko style machines. It was kind of like pinball. And yeah, we were, you know, drinking and ripping around. I forget the name of the town or whatever, but it wasn't anything too different than what we were doing in Vancouver or Whistler. We were just doing it in Japan.
Yeah, sick.
But we went to Europe too. Paul took us to Switzerland. We were supposed to shoot an article for Snowboarder magazine. And we got word the week before we were to leave to Europe that they were having just a dry year.
Oh no.
And we were like, well, frick, man, like the trip's paid for already. We've got the tickets. We've got the accommodation. You know, Paul's like, what are you guys thinking? Like, let's go. Like,
yeah, of course.
Let's freaking go, man. So we went to Switzerland for like 8 or 9 days or something. And the conditions were dry. Like there was snow up towards the glacier and you had to take like 3 gondolas to get up to the top of the mountain. It's crazy in Europe. Like there, it's not ski areas. It's ski mountain ranges over there.
Yeah.
They have lifts everywhere. And to get up to the snow to do this like demo or contest that they had, we had to take, I remember, like legitimately 3 gondolas, which I guess really is just maybe like one more than Whistler or Blackcomb might be.
Yeah.
But yeah, we got way up there and there, and again, the same thing. We get to the top of the 3rd gondola and we get out, and our guy that's like touring us around, he's like, look over there, there's Mont Blanc in France. And I'm like, oh, sick. Like, rad. And I turn around and my buds are gone. It's like snowboard time. And I'm like, oh yeah, charge, right, charge. Forgot about that. No looking around. Like
unreal. Yeah,
Switzerland was legit. That was fun. We ate fondue and all that typical stuff. And
yeah,
bread and cheese for breakfast. Yeah. Time of my life over there though. That was good.
That's rad.
Yeah.
Was it a snowboarder story? Did you end up getting a story on snowboarder? A couple of photos?
I don't remember very much coming out of that because it was too thin to do a big story about. I don't even think Snowboarder magazine like followed us over there or sent a photographer.
Yeah, so they're like, we got to send our guy wherever there's snow.
Yeah. And which is fair. But Paul was a good, you know, PR guy or whatever.
Oh,
he,
totally.
He got us to Japan. He got us to Switzerland. He offered me one summer to go to Australia in our summer, their winter,
yeah,
to like go and hang out in their ski resorts with the luxury distributor over there and stuff. And ironically, at the time, I was pretty hyped on this chick, and I was like, I don't know, I'm just going to chill here or whatever. And no regrets, you know, obviously, I was happy to stay here and all my friends were here. But yeah, that might have been like a trip that I would say that I wish I might have gone on at this point. I still to this day haven't been to Australia, and I've heard phenomenal things about their culture and their lifestyle being very similar to Canada's. And I do hope to make it there one day.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I've never been either to the, yeah. I've never been to the southern hemisphere, but and I've never been to Europe either for yeah. snowboarding. I've gone as a tourist when I was a kid, but I mean, it's such a huge planet. There's so many places to go, man. Did you do any California trips? Tahoe's insane. Yeah. When I went last year, I was so psyched.
I have so much thanks to snowboarding. I love being in a car and traveling around as just my nature goes. And snowboarding allowed me the opportunity to go to Idaho and Wyoming and Colorado and California and Washington and Oregon and the U.S. Open in Vermont.
Wow.
And like, yeah, man, we were zigzagging across, basically, yeah, I would say the U.S. more than Canada, because it kind of ended at Lake Louise and Sunshine. So
yeah.
We would go south and we were putting on tons of K, driving from ski resort to ski resort. And again, it was like lean, dude. We were lean in money and yeah. We were just making it happen. It was so crazy how there was just no doubt that we were just going to be doing it. And yeah, we went to Tahoe and I remember riding like however high with the top of, it was in Montana. There was a super high, big sky in Montana,
big sky,
and being way up there. And it felt like the Arctic up there. Like it was way up there.
Yeah.
And, I got to experience tons and tons of the United States through snowboarding, meeting all types of people, staying at their houses, obviously, like they would if they came to Whistler or Vancouver. And I got to snowboard at, you know, so many phenomenal world famous ski resorts that I'm so proud to tick off that list.
How'd you do at the Open?
We didn't compete. I went with Chris Nichols and Jeff Hofflin, and we didn't actually compete in the Open. We just went there because we'd met Brushy and Winfield and all of those guys like had come to Whistler in the summertime, and we became friends with them, and we were actually pretty tight with those guys. So they invited us back east to go and hang out with them at their, you know, home event.
So sick.
Like we didn't even question 55 hours of driving across Canada to dip down into Vermont and go to the US Open.
God.
But at the time, I don't even know how I would have even thought to enter the U.S. Open. I don't.
Right.
I don't. It seemed pretty prestigious. And
an invitational or something,
yeah,
right.
I don't know how it went because we just didn't even consider entering it. We were just there hanging.
Oh, that's so sick.
Yeah.
Dude, this is such a fun conversation because you're making me realize like those days were better in a lot of ways than what was to come, right? Like for these guys that signed, you know, $100,000 contracts.
Yeah, pay it back, boys.
Well, they're stuck going to some random place, getting off a plane, going to a hotel room, sitting there by themselves, go to the contest, see a few people that they know. Hey, practice.
Yeah.
Go in the event, get back to the hotel room, sleep, get on a plane, go to the next place.
Yeah.
Like I would way rather roll up to Whistler and then be crashing on Kevin and Anthony's couch.
Sure.
And now you're going to the best spots on the mountain with the best guys. And everywhere you go, you wind up in Colorado and you're riding with the best guys at Breck, or you're riding with the best guys in Idaho.
Absolutely.
You ever ride with Keith Wallace? Duck Boy was
Idaho
dude.
We never rode with Keith Wallace very much other than maybe in the summertime up up at the glacier.
Yeah.
Brushy, Terje, we were kind of tight with those guys. They were buds of ours in the summertime, and we would hang with those guys at night. And Jimmy Scott was a friend of mine too.
Sick.
And Estes was on our team. But because of the glacier, there was two glaciers, obviously Hood and Whistler, and everybody always came to Whistler. Whistler had like way more to offer lifestyle wise than Hood did. Hood was a mountain that you drove up to, and there was no like village and concrete skate park and bars and everything. Like it was all there, and it was very attractive for any snowboarder in North America to come to Whistler. So we were very, we were tight with all these guys. And when we went back their way, they were more than happy to share the love of what their local town was like.
That's so rad.
But those snowboarders you're talking about a few minutes ago, staying in their hotel rooms and stuff. I mean, it sounds kind of like a job, you know, like, in the summertime when we were walking around all brash with our, you know, wife beater shirts and drinking, walking through the village, like, I remember like we'd walk in packs and Rankwit was leading the way, and we'd be walking by like security guards at the bar, and he'd be like, look at you, you got a job. And we were like, we don't have jobs. We're just snowboarders, man. Like, and job was the big, like, bad word. It was bad to have a job. So yeah, different time and solely focused on just being snowboarders.
That's so sick.
Yeah.
So when do you have to get a job? At what point do you get a job?
1996, 97. Ken Achenbach finally hires me and Nick's as coaches up at the Camp Champions. There was a little backstory. There was kind of this weird beef between the snowboard shop and skaters. He was like North Calgary and we were South Calgary. And he drummed up this this feud for some reason. I don't know why. It was maybe just because we were the new shop and maybe stealing his business. I don't know, whatever it was. So we couldn't really get jobs at the camp for all these years. And finally Nick's and I are sitting in Ken's hotel room and we're like, dude, like we're all adults here. That was 10 years ago. Like, can we just get over it? Hire us. We live here. We're locals, you know, like we'll work. It's all good. And he does. And another coach that year was like a young doe-eyed child, 15, 16 years old, Trevor Andrew. And Trevor comes up and he lives in the coach's house. It's me, Nick's, Roberta Roger, and Trevor Andrew in our coach's house. And much like I got the gears at back in the day from Culling and Kearns and stuff, we just started laying into that kid. And we were like, here's life education, dude. Like grizzled 26-year-old dudes who've been like going at it for 10, 12 years, we're going to start laying into you and it's education time. And we snowboarded all summer. And towards the end of the summer, I took Trevor in my car to a meeting with Burton. And he went up into the hotel and he met with Burton and he came back out an hour later and I drove him back to the thing. And I was like, how'd that go? He was like, oh, good, man. I signed a $50,000 a year contract with Burton. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm done. Because I had never made more than $500 a month, you know?
Like, right.
And that's when snowboarding started to become monetary. And people were starting to sign contracts and starting to make money. And the business side of it was, you know, Mountain Dew is coming into things and whatever Kokanee was coming into things.
Sure.
And there was outside sponsors that weren't the snowboard companies. And these companies were influxing money. And that was kind of it for me, man. It was like, I'd realized that, you know, these kids are bouncing off the snow and I'm slamming into the snow and they're making money and I'm not. And, so I just kind of reeled back and did it for fun at that point after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it probably would have coincided with Culling closing down Luxury. And
Luxury had like a 3 or 4 year span. I had a second pro model after the Nordiques model, which was a Boris Vallejo inspired graphic. Well, more than inspired, ripoff of a Boris Vallejo graphic, like the, you know, the barbarian chick with three saber-toothed tigers at the end of her chain, and she's standing on a rock and stuff. And it was much more sellable.
Yeah.
But that board was sick, man, because like it was the first year of cap construction that Mervin had made. And Mervin was leading the way in cap construction at the time. And they, thank God, like let us at Luxury have cap construction too. And man, if my pride wasn't soaring out the roof at like, you know, having one of the sickest, newest construction styles available out there from one of the coolest companies, you know, like being manufactured by one of the coolest companies. And I think Luxury had a great name, and I was proud as hell to ride for them. They gave us bent metal bindings at the time, which were hardcore and metal. And like, you know, it was like my kit was legit. And I was like, so hyped on my stuff, man. And it like, as an athlete, whether it's your snowboard or your golf clubs or your hockey stick, whatever, you want to look down and you want to feel real good about what you're looking at. And it instills a sense of confidence in you to perform whatever you're going to be doing that day. And I was really, really proud of especially that second board, that cap construction purple board with the bent metal bindings. Like I thought that was the shit, man. And I was really hyped to be, you know, owning that one.
That's so sick. Yeah. So where are you living at that time? Did you at some point move up to Pemby or?
No, it was, I was still living in the city, but by then,
Cause you moved down.
I moved down to the city. Yeah. Like after that first year, but I was spending tons of time in, Whistler, but my friends at that time, which were not like the whiskey guys and not the CSM guys, but I was more like Nix and Tank and KY and Sabine and Anthony. Like they were, a couple of those guys owned houses up in Pemberton.
Right.
So we were snowboarding in Whistler, but we were always going back to Pemberton. And we kind of just stayed up there a lot of that year or two. And we didn't really go back to Whistler to party that much. We were just hanging up there and playing cards and
more
drinking,
quiet and drinking
a little bit. Yeah. Like we weren't the head smashing bottle guys. We weren't like the, you know, sleeping under tires, passed out guys. We were more like the weed guys and the poker guys and the beer guys and the Crown Royal guys, up in Pemberton. And it was a bit of a different crew than all of those guys. Still obviously super fun and still obviously our, you know, everyone was main friends, but yeah, we were towards the end there. I was more staying out in Pemberton way.
Did you get a sled or did that happen? Like basically when you stopped, everybody started getting sleds.
Yeah, that's exactly about right. Like sleds might've come in, you know, a couple guys had them 95, 96, but it became norm right after me to get a sled and head into the background, get out of those dreaded lineups you were talking about and be out in the open and really able to explore and express yourself out in the backcountry. I did go snowmobiling. I did go heli skiing. I did go catboarding. And yeah, like when you're out in the back like that, it's quiet. It's a slower pace. There's no time to it. There's no lift lines or other people. And it's just golden hour back there, man. And I can see why that's such a popular way to snowboard nowadays. It's, and the snowmobiling's fun as hell too in its own.
Yeah. I bought a sled this year for the first time.
Yeah.
I haven't even used it yet. Oh. I mean, it's still pretty early. It's still November.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
But, oh, fuck. I still love it as much as when you're talking about like being a kid. And
yeah, man.
I went away from it when I had kids, but now that I'm back at it, I'm still just frothing.
Yeah.
But it's like way crazier now as far as like you really have to pick your time and get it while it's good and then get the hell out of there. But, you know, so we're going into December when there's snow in Vancouver. You have to basically avoid the mountains for, you know, the Christmas break. Once the kids are out of school, it's chaos until January, and then it's all ours again. It's fun.
No, it's nuts around here.
You still
have
a kit? You still go up from time to time?
Yeah, I mean, my board's like, it's an older, you know, 7-year-old Burton that Kearns gave me a while back or whatever. But to me, like, it's, I don't think the technology is any shit indifferent that board's like out of date or anything. Although I have had people say, oh, look at that. Like, what's up with that? Where I'm like, I don't know. It works totally fine, dude. Like,
you should be riding your pro model, man, with some bent metal bindings on there. Yeah. That shit is still legit. I had a Dukester from that era that I rode up locally not that long ago.
Yeah.
Those Mervyn boards are still 100% like a rideable board.
I don't know that I could trust the dry ass base though, man. I would want to try to keep up. So
we'd have to get it base ground.
Super waxed. The hell.
Did you keep a couple of your pro models just to,
I got one of each. Have? Yeah. Good. I got one of each, but I don't have one of each in new, like not in the, in the plastic, so to speak. So
it was a different era back then. Like, if you were to do that back then, people would be like, you're weird. Why are you keeping a brand new one of your own board, you egomaniac?
It's a lot easier for pro skaters to keep a board than it is. Like, I mean, snowboards are like $600-$700 back then. And I'm
totally.
Like, I need that $600-$700
bucks. Money. Yeah, totally.
But I do have one. They're at the back of my closet. They're total source of pride of mine, and I'll never ever get rid of that.
Yeah.
I still have, you know, every magazine that I had a picture in, or
I love that.
Yeah, I still have, like, you know, being skateboarders and snowboarders, I have a box of skateboard stickers, I have a box of snowboard stickers. Like, I'm still a 50-year-old kid when it comes to all of that, and I still get a lot of pleasure out of, like, looking back. I had my 50th birthday back in March, and I wanted to make, like, a cool Instagram post. So I pulled out all my snowboard shots that I had in magazines and stuff. And it was, like, great running down memory lane again. And I'll never get rid of that stuff. And I'll never get rid of those three boards. They're, you know, they're a part of my footprint in this life. And I was very, very proud of that part of my life. It was, I've had a lot of fun my entire life. I've always focused on making sure I'm having fun. I'm not too stressed and I'm not too worked. And that clip there for 8 to 10 years of amateur and pro snowboarding, dude, just highlight reel in my life. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Eric. It's been a pleasure talking to you too, my friend.
Stoked, dude.
Okay.
Evan Rad shout outs this week to Mark Castlegay. And special thanks to Mike Strato for linking me up with this OG Whistler legend. Fast and Loose is a company run by some great friends of mine. They're offering stickers and wax and more great things down the line. So follow Fast and Loose on Instagram for more info. Thanks again to Brian from DeKine. My hands are always warm thanks to the epic gloves he set me up with. And I'm still rocking the bibs he flowed me years back because they still work. Extra special thanks to Jason Hilton this week. I've got a new BCA airbag vest and radio, thanks to Hilti. And he's constantly helping me upgrade my 20-year-old bindings. He's a legend. All right, be sure to come back next week for another episode of the Effin' Rad Snowboarding Podcast, presented by Vans and brought to you by SIA Productions.